This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Tonight, our guest is Dr. Richard Morgan, a professor in the Geography Department at Otago University, and our show is hosted by Professor Samuel Mann and me, Shane Gallagher, and we're really excited because we're back live in the studio, which we haven't been for how many months, the two of us?
Well, you would get involved in an election.
Yeah, well, people make me do these things. That guy in the mirror looking, and he's like, oh, you have to do this. I know, that's crazy. How many months has it been? I can't even remember.
August.
Oh my, that's a long time. And it was really weird because I come back and look on the board and think, oh, which buttons do I press? So, welcome to our show tonight. And so I have my number of the week, which I haven't done for ages. And my number is 400. And that's 400 parts per million, which is the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And you may notice that it's 50 parts per million above what was considered to be the safe limit of 350 parts per million. And we're adding 2 parts per million of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere every single year. So unless we're able to rapidly turn that around and get below the 350 parts per million this century, we risk triggering tipping points and irreversible impacts that could send the climate change spinning truly beyond our control. And as part of the citizen-initiated actions to combat climate change, 350.org and a few other environmental organisations have made Friday the 13th, that's tomorrow, Global Divestment Day. So people are organising across the world to get organisations like universities, unions, councils, banks, etc. to divest from fossil fuel industries. It has been a very successful campaign and is gaining more and more momentum. So the local action here in Dunedin is to gather at the Octagon at 12 p.m. tomorrow, Friday 13th, and ask Dunedin City Council to divest from fossil fuels. And it has been making positive noises about that it may well do so in the future, but they need to be encouraged to do the right thing, as politicians always do. And so if you want to help out, just turn up at 12 p.m. at the Octagon and join 350.org to help persuade Dunedin City Council to divest, and bring a friend with you. And so that's my number of the week, 400. And it needs to become 350. And we're not doing a Sam's Thought for the Week because we want to rush on and talk to Professor Richard Morgan. But we're going to have a quick promo first from our sponsor.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Our guest tonight is Professor Richard Morgan. He got his PhD from the University of Birmingham in the UK for the study of the effects of human activities and contemporary forest dynamics in the New Forest near Southampton. He took up a lecturing position at Otago University shortly afterwards, and over the years his biogeographical interests broadened to include the investigation of the impacts of human activities on soil systems. And at the same time, he developed an interest in environmental management and especially strategies and methods to avoid or reduce human impacts on the environment. His inaugural professoral lecture was entitled From Orange Boxes to Tsunamis and Climate Change, Realising the Potential of Impact Assessment, which sounds very interesting. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
So you were born in the UK?
Yes.
And yeah. You were raised where?
I'm a Yorkshire lad, originally.
I thought I recognised the northern accent.
Yeah, that's right. And then we migrated south in the 1960s, sort of economic migration within Britain. And, I then spent some time there before going down to the south coast for tertiary education, Portsmouth Polytechnic. So I'm a polytechnic boy as well, although it was a London University degree, and then back up to Birmingham for the PhD.
And what got you interested in geography? What was this something, or is just that head looks interesting?
I suppose it's the usual story. You feel you've got some sort of innate talent or interest in an area, so you try and develop that. And you have a teacher who can really encourage you. And I think it was really sort of a combination of, you know, family, teacher, and just basic interest as much as anything.
Brilliant. And a question I've always asked about the New Forest, how did the New Forest get its name? Because I know it's quite a, it's a big forest. And yeah. How did it get its name? Do you know?
It was new because the when the Normans took over in 1066 and subsequently, they decided that they would adopt that particular area as their new forest for hunting, so they christened it the New Forest. So it's actually a very old hunting forest, and of course the word forest doesn't mean covered with trees, it means a hunting area. So it could be non-tree covered. The New Forest is this lovely, it's a national park now, lovely mix of heathland, old forest, and some forestry commission planting as well. So, you know, history is very diverse and sort of ecologically, historically. So wonderful area.
Was it managed by the locals? I mean, was it a managed area? Did they coppice it and then areas? Yeah. And stuff?
So how long have you got for this program?
Well, I was just really interested in the New Forest. Not very long.
It's, as a lot of these areas in Britain, it's evolved through the centuries, through the millennia. And so there's some interesting customary practices that still go on today, that the locals have rights of collecting firewood or letting their pigs into the forest and all those sorts of things. And the native forests, the ancient and ornamental woodlands, they call them, those are the bits that have never been cleared since primeval times. But they're heavily affected by those sorts of practices. And the New Forest ponies are the well-known sort of livestock in the area. And those impacts have really shaped the system quite dramatically over the years. But that means there's original biota and human-modified systems that now have great ecological value and are worth preserving because of that. So, yeah, fantastic area.
So what dragged you to Otago?
1979. This was a very bad time for the UK in employment terms, and I was applying for work all over the place. Nigeria, Papua New Guinea, you know, anywhere, and New Zealand. And I'd forgotten I applied here and got a cable saying, you've got a job, when can you get here? So we negotiated 6 months for me to finish a postdoc and come out, and I came for 3 years.
Wow, and how did you do interviews back then? Because there was no Skype or...
thank God they didn't interview me. They they took letters of reference and trusted the referees, which is probably a good thing. They took a risk. Did it pay off? What do you think, Sam?
It did. What did you want to be when you grew up? Before I grew up?
Yeah. You know, I really don't know. I tested the idea of being a planner, and I sort of drifted into PhD work that then drifted into academia, really just following interest. So I didn't have a strong sense, a vocational sense of what I wanted to do, but I knew what was interesting and what wasn't. I fairly quickly decided I didn't want to be a local authority planner.
Was it the trees in particular, or was it the human vegetation system combined? Or perhaps something else?
Yeah, it was rural. The rural ecology, I suppose we call it now, very much the... the familiarity with flowers and birds and so on, hedgerows and copses and that lived environment, which I really got, I think, especially from my mother and her family from the Norfolk side. You know, there was a gamekeeper several generations back and there were rural labourers and this sort of thing. So I think that sort of semi-peasant heritage sort of came down quite strongly. And so I've always had flowers in particular have always been a real interest. And that really just grew into a fascination with that human relationship with natural systems and how we change them and how we, if you like, create new systems that have value that culturally that we want to preserve in the end. We're starting to see that here, I think, rather slow than other places.
So we've had this long history of these lived environments, and over the millennium we've been quite good at it. Are we still good at it, and if not, what's changed?
Do you mean are we good at creating them, or are we good at managing to keep them going and not mess them up too much? Both. I think it depends where you're talking about. You look at the situation in this country, this is one of the best teaching examples of how major human invasion of a country can change it rapidly by use of more modern technology than we had several thousand years ago. And so increasingly, the last 150 years, we've seen dramatic change. That change has been experienced at slower rates, say in the Pacific Islands, but they've changed inexorably by trial and error to create systems that they have that they now manage in what they would think of as a customary way, but they're modified environments. So it depends where you look as to what we have now. How are we doing? We're still going into areas and changing them too quickly, I think, in some cases. In other cases, we're managing existing modified environments very sensitively, and in some cases, we're winding the clock back and trying to perhaps return to a slightly earlier stage and increase the, bring biodiversity back and so on. There was a interesting BBC podcast recently, from our own foreign correspondent, one of those broadcasts. They were talking about South Georgia, island in the Southern Atlantic, and how since they've had the big rat eradication problem program, they've managed to vastly increase the seabird population, bring back quite rare birds in large numbers. It's the sort of thing we're sort of familiar with in this country, but it's happening all the way around the world. We're sort of moving the clock back a little bit. We'll never get back to where we were, but I think we're managing those systems with a lot more insight and thoughtfulness. On the other hand, we are mining Mongolia to death so that we can have our iPods and iPads and non-Apple products as well, Samsungs and so on. So, depending where you look.
We're pretty good at hiding from that, though.
Yeah. It's a long way away. We don't really need to worry about it. But there are people out there who are raising the alarms and trying to get the words around, and I think we need to think about that and reflect on it when we are using our new gadgets, that there is a cost to that. Not that we shouldn't use them, not that we shouldn't develop them, but perhaps we need to be thinking about environmental outreach and helping those countries develop the sort of standards we're striving for.
You've answered why geography for yourself. Why should my daughter and your daughter do geography?
My daughter, who doesn't want to do it because she's embarrassed about her dad.
And my daughter, who eventually admitted that that's what she should be doing.
Yeah. I think it's for people who, first of all, are interested in the world around them, the way it works, but not just in a descriptive sense. They want to understand the processes almost abstract processes that lead to the patterns, the features, the things we see around us. That can be in the natural world. Why do we have mountains with glaciers and the funny climate distribution of the South Island and why the soils the way they are and so on? It can be on the human side. Why do we have Omru where it is? Why do we have Timaru where it is? Why are they growing in different ways? How are they changing with different economic situations? But especially it's bringing those two together. Why is Central Otago now going through another cycle of development of natural resources to create productive systems that themselves may be having effects on, say, water, soil, and so on, or on social services, or on cultural issues? Are we bringing so many rich people in that we're pushing local people out of areas that, you know, they feel they should have access to? All of that is what geographers look at and think about and try and analyse and understand. And there's scope there for people with all sorts of interest areas to get involved and find an area they can work in that sort of way. So I think it's a, you know, fascinating meta-discipline, which sort of contrasts with rather more focused, equally important but more focused disciplines that really drill down more to more specific things. We're using that to build bigger visions, bigger understandings, and I think that suits certain people really well.
You mentioned there natural geography and then human geography. What does geography have a philosophical stance about where humanity lies in relationship to nature? What's the relationship between humanity and nature in geography? Maybe for geographers,
yeah.
Is there like this artificial? Is there a separation or
no? I think pretty much all geographers would, you know, if you define it as the study of the of people in their environment, then it's assuming that there is a rightful place for people in their living space, and it's how they operate within that living space is what geography is about. And so we're using the evidence around us to try and tease out those processes, those relationships. But, you know, people have a right to exist. They have a right to use resources. They have a right to modify their environment in order to survive as a species. So I think that's taken as a given. So I suspect a deep ecologist would never be happy converting to being a geographer. You know, there's more separation there, I think.
So there is a philosophical stance then. Is there kind of
I think it's implicit, yeah.
Would it be like Cartesian, that sense that we're separate from nature somehow, that we're slightly outside it, or is there a different understanding?
Yeah, I think different people would argue that in different ways, even in geography. I put that sort of those contrasts to students to get them to think about why different communities have acted in different ways. So pioneer communities that see the natural world as full of resources there to be utilized and hazards and risks to be suppressed so that people can live happily with that strong sort of mandate from Genesis in the Bible that we're here to dominate nature, or other traditions that say we need to work more harmoniously because that will be better for the future for all of us. Those are traditions that you see in society. Geography looks at those in order to understand why people do things. What individual geographers might believe, I think, is their personal stuff. I don't think it necessarily flows into geography as a... It doesn't have a single ideology in that sense. But I think we're looking at that as part of understanding why we've had environmental change and trying to think about ways that we can lay that out so people can decide for themselves how they want to change, if they want to change.
Is that an active conversation that's happening in geographical circles, or is it just happening in the background and people are... Are people talking about this, or is it not? Because artists are talking about it, because we've had lots of people coming on talking about, you know, how do we reimagine this relationship with nature? You know, what is our relationship with nature? And so I'm just wondering if that conversation is happening in the geographical circles.
Yeah, certainly. In an academic sense, there's lots of discussion, lots of debate, lots of research about those different perspectives and how we should be reacting to that, the different responses that researchers, teachers, and so on can take to try and influence people to think about it and to adopt different ways of behaving. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a really lively, if you like, environmental geography or a sustainability dimension to geography. It depends which literatures you go to. You know, academics love their different literatures. So some areas are totally devoted to that. Other areas are just getting on doing their geomorphology or their soils or whatever, and perhaps not really listening to that. So, but I think it is out there. It is current, you know, and there are people passionate about that stuff, certainly.
Mm. Where does the line fall between botany and biogeography?
Ooh. Do you want to declare any conflict of interest here, Sam, before I go on?
No, you go.
Biogeography is one of those areas that my human geography colleagues would describe as a contested space. Not contested in a negative sense, but it's a term that's used by botanists and zoologists and various others to describe what a geographer would think of as quite simplistic stuff, understanding spatial distributions of plants and animals and so on, and especially the historic dimension. So looking at the flora of New Zealand over the last 100 million years and looking at how it's changed and so on, that would be biogeography in a sort of a botanical sense. And to a certain extent, in geography, we have an interest in that. But the sort of biogeography we do is coming back to that, you know, people-environment interaction. And we're saying, well, let's look at the biological world and understand it so that we can then understand how human communities interact with it. And so first we need to know how it operates as a collection of animals and plants and insects and as ecosystems and so on. And then we can start looking at human disruption and creation of new ecosystems, problems brought about by development, human impacts and so on. And so it's bringing the biological side into geography in order to understand the human impact dimension. And I think that surprises people because a lot of people would say take a paper in physical geography thinking they're going to do rocks and rivers and climate. And then I come along and say, don't forget the flowers. And they go, oh, you know, don't really know about flowers. But we get in there and we start looking at actually what's really important, which is the living world that people directly deal with all the time. You know, growing veggies in the back garden, they're using the soil. They need to know how the soil works. So it's stuff that they're perhaps not thinking about that is very important on an everyday basis.
So that they can manage the environment? Or are they being managed by the environment?
Both. Well, there's some interesting philosophical debates in geography about 100 years ago. Environmental determinism. There was a time when there was a strong ethos in geography that we were looking at how settlements, communities, livelihoods and so on were very much determined by the nature of the environment. So classic one I always remember that we were taught early on was the difference between cooking in island and cooking in China, the different cuisines, the peat, the long, slow cooking style in Ireland, so we get stews and, you know, long cooked meats, shortage of fuel wood in China, so the rapid cooking, and therefore you'd have, you know, very rapidly cooked stir fries and so on. You know, a very simplistic example of environmental determinism. I think everyone would agree it's not as simple as that. There are issues there, but so what we're talking about is recognizing the some of the constraints the environment puts on us, living systems as well as the non-living systems, but also, you know, which is the flow from the systems into humankind, but also the reverse flow. How do we, through our actions, change them? And then we get feedback loops backwards and forwards. And it's understanding that and knowing how to analyze it and deal with it is really what we're trying to lay out, I think.
In normal management, people would talk about resources mostly being labor and capital. Environmental management brings in a whole different set of resources, but also constraints. And I'm thinking about irrigation, that there just isn't any more water, or the, you know, however much we might want to pay to catch more fish, there isn't any more. Does that, is that substantively different from what they might teach in the management school?
I suppose, no, not really. I think in business, your resources are not infinite. You'd recognise what resources you have to achieve certain objectives, and you would use them hopefully fairly carefully and efficiently to achieve what you want to do. I think what we're doing with environmental management is, I think we're focusing on not trying to point people towards new productive ways of using ecosystems as critiquing the ways things are being done. And one of them might be to say, well, we've got dairying spreading, you know, throughout the country really rapidly in some areas. Have we really checked to see if there is enough water, not just for dairying, but for other people who may have legitimate calls on that resource? So we have to think of it in a, it is a resource management problem, and we've got to raise the issue of how do we measure what is available, and how do we understand the demand for that, and how competing demands will affect each other, and what sort of decision-making process is appropriate. Do we just simply put a price on water and let people with money buy as much as they need, or do we have some sort of collaborative allocation process or whatever? And those are some interesting questions that, you know, we're going through at the moment in this country, and that's happening in other countries as well. Water's probably, you know, one of the most contentious issues globally, between communities, between nations. Building dams and denying water across boundaries, who has access to drinking water and who doesn't, you know, it's so understanding how much there is, understanding the seasonal cycles, the natural disruptions to supply, how many droughts we're going to get in the next 50 years, you know, is all about having a good understanding that we can then feed into allocation and sensible usage. So I think we're, you know, environmental management is really recognizing, coming in from a different perspective in that sense compared to management of an organization. But, you know, I think we're still trying to instill professional thinking about how we deal with that.
And also thinking at very different scales.
Yeah, definitely.
Management doesn't tend to think in 50, 100-year scales and essentially irreversible actions.
No. And they do have a habit of imposing a discount on their cost-benefit analysis that is ludicrous if you try and do that in natural resources, you know, with a 50-year time limit. It just doesn't work. But that's not insurmountable. Yep. Different time scales, different spatial scales. Being aware of that and recognizing the issues that can arise in those different temporal spatial scales is important. Yeah.
Those are quantitative measures. Is there room for qualitative measures? How do you assess, for instance, the amenity of a stream, or if you're extracting water? I mean, how do you measure the quality of that stream for the life in that? Is there a space for that?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's been the big switch in perhaps the last 10, 20 years probably, mm-hmm. has been recognizing that values doesn't just mean monetary value or narrow utilitarian value. It's cultural, it's spiritual, it's ecological, it's social, it's all sorts of things. Amenity value, as you say. So how we take that into account is quite an important area of discussion in all sorts of applied areas. I'm more familiar with it in impact assessment, where we say, well, if we go ahead with this project, it will require, for instance, so much water from this catchment or this aquifer. How do we value that? And we could do it in monetary terms, but we can also do it by talking to people and using social science ways or almost ethnographic ways of getting that information and presenting it to decision makers. And decision makers are now much more aware that they can't just take a number and say, well, we'll go with the number and not these expressions of opinion. In fact, I think they'd be more swayed by good, well-founded, passionate opinion from a local community than an accountant saying, this is worth $300. It's that sort of expression of value that's becoming much more important. And certainly in this country, there's been, I think, quite a lot of recognition, a lot of work to bring in Maori values of especially water, and therefore the need for that sort of holistic ecological and spiritual and utilitarian set of values that Maori have about water, habitat, food source, etc.
Do you... Things like fish have a claim in water. I mean, you maybe say there's a stream, it's a beautiful stream, but we want, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, let's take water out for the dairies. But yeah. Does, like, for instance, a freshwater fish that's maybe endangered, does yeah. that species have a claim? And is there any way of expressing that?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because we're talking this very, very from a human perspective. Is there a non-human perspective that we can advocate for?
Yeah. I'm sitting here. Listeners, grinning, because it just reminded me of when I first started here back in the early 80s and I was doing a paper on what I call environmental evaluation. And one of the first books I found was a book by a guy called Lawrence Stone, I think his name was, Do Trees Have Standing? And it was exactly that. Do trees have a right to exist independent of us? And that really comes down to how we as individuals want to play that in our value systems, our belief systems. So some, you know, deep ecologists would say, of course, things have an intrinsic value, they have a right to exist. We don't have a right to stop them existing. More utilitarian views, an ecologist would say, well, a good ecosystem needs those fish species. We can't do without them. If we take them out, the system is degraded, it won't work well. So we've got to keep them. They have a value, if you like. They have a right to exist as a member of this community. Anglers would say, of course they have a right to exist because they're what we like to haul out and eat or put back. So it depends on how people want to philosophically deal with it. It's a personal question, I think. And again, my job as an academic is to point people to those debates and say, so what do you think? Not necessarily to tell you what I think.
Particularly when those values are in conflict.
There will be conflict, yes, definitely. And that's so we need people to recognise. So a good example, yesterday, was it? The Environmental Protection Agency released their decision not to allow mining of rock phosphate nodules on the Chatham Rise. And in the paper this morning, the business community said, well, this is, the process is wrong. It's stopping development. You know, here's this valuable resource, and you're using this legislation to stop people legitimately developing resource, developing an economy, creating jobs, growing the economy, da-da-da-da. Predictably, the Greens, the conservationists, the ecologists were in rapture. This is excellent. You know, we've got the legislation working the way it should. And there you've got two very different ways of valuing the marine biota that would have been affected, maybe, we're not quite sure, by this activity. EPA said there's not enough evidence to say it won't be affected, so we won't allow it to go ahead. You know, and the business community saying, well, we think we've got the evidence, let us go ahead. So, you know, it's values every time, and the conflict and how we negotiate our way through those is really important.
Bigger question, sustainability. Is sustainability geography in disguise?
No. Next question?
Yeah, all right. And why not?
You want me to unpack that one?
Yeah.
Depends what you mean, what you think sustainability is. To me, disciplines like geography or ecology or zoology, botany, so on, are generating understanding. And therefore feeding information to people who want to think about these issues and determine where they stand. Sustainability is sort of a moral standpoint. I won't say an ideology, I think it's a moral standpoint. It's a belief that we should operate in certain ways vis-a-vis the world around us. Okay, that's good. And I'm sure a lot of geographers, other academics of natural sciences or social sciences would agree with that. But the job of the discipline is not necessarily to promote a particular moral standpoint so much as to, I think, inform the debate about those standpoints. So I think perhaps it would be fairer to say there is a lot of relevance in what we do to inform people's understanding of sustainability and to help them articulate their own view on it, whether it's I've got to be careful, not narrow, but quite a purist view of sustainability versus a more utilitarian view. Where do you stand? How do you make that choice? Here's information. It's now for you to decide that as communities, as nations, as global communities.
Is geography, I get the feeling that geography isn't a hard science like physics. It kind of starts drifting toward, where's the boundary between geography and environmental sociology? And where are those kind of boundaries? And is geography, a lot of it is obviously hard science with geomorphology and all that stuff I don't know much about, but where does it stand on that spectrum?
When you say hard science, you didn't mean difficult to do. You actually rocky things, didn't you? Geography is not a hard science. It's easy, everybody. Come and do it.
It's just about maps.
Oh, no. You haven't asked that one yet. It's within the boundary of what we do, around this central notion of understand your environment of whatever kind it is and think of human interactions, we do go from quite strong physical earth science through biological science through to social science through to humanism, really. So there's that scope, and these are all different ways of understanding the world. So if we want to understand, this stuff, we need to measure it and do things with it. But if we're talking about people and behavior and how they think and their perceptions and value judgments, it's much softer. So we're bringing those methods, we're sharing methods with sociology and psychology and so on. Environmental sociology is an interesting question. I think there are some really strong interlinkages there where we're talking about communities and society and societal processes. It's like ecology and biogeography. There'd be some strong overlaps, but I think it's difference in perspective and what we use the information for. And the geographers would use that social understanding to feed into the people-environment mix and applying that to decision-making and management and so on. I shouldn't really speak for the sociologists, but I probably will. I think they've got different perspectives and constructing their understanding for different reasons, for use in different ways, really. They're teasing out social processes that help them understand why people react and relate to each other and relate to their environment in different ways. And that's where we would interconnect, definitely.
You said, I'm really fascinated by this idea that you said, like, sustainability is a moral stance. And I really agree with you. But do you think there has been enough debate about what sustainability actually is? Because one of the things I kind of struggle with is, trying to pin that down. We've had the definitions from the various reports. But what is this thing that we're kind of like, scooting around what is sustainability? And you said it's a moral stance. Do you think we need to talk more about it?
I think the word is problematic because it does take on different meanings for different people. And it doesn't matter how much academics publish literature saying there are these 5 or 10 different types of sustainability. That term is owned by the wider population, and they will use it as they see fit. I think what's more important is the ethos, and I think the basic ethos is that we need to think carefully about how we live and how it affects the environment, which includes people, and that we're making choices every day in what we do, and we need to be thinking whether some of those choices could have rather unfortunate effects, especially in the longer term. Certain things get picked up at different times, in different years, different decades. We don't hear a lot about acid rain anymore, but acid rain's still out there, folks. It's all climate change now, but that's such an umbrella term for all sorts of things. It again loses meaning. Fashions change in terms of issues. But the basic ethos that I think has emerged in the last 40, 50 years is humans as a species need to think very carefully about how we live, how we use resources. We've got to be much more efficient about reusing. We've got to be much more efficient about using things that can't be renewed. We've got to look for different resources that are not going to pollute to the extent that past pollution occurred, etc. And I think that message is quite widely understood. Sustainability is sort of a label that sort of goes over that, but perhaps is a bit fuzzy. Maybe we should just talk about the ethos and not worry about the label.
What can the community then take from geography? You said that the role of geography is to inform the debate. For non-geographers, other than those sort of stories and bringing those particular issues to the fore, are there particular methods perhaps that non-geographers could take and say, that's something really useful, I could use that in how I think about things? It's more than maps.
Beyond maps. I think it's... That's a really tricky one. I mean, I fall back on the sorts of tools and mechanisms and processes that naturally come to me. That is, you know, we want to inform decision making. And so for me, the area of impact assessment is a particular tool. It's not a geographic tool solely, but it is one that is very good for transmitting geographic learning, understanding, along with other sorts of understanding, and putting it in front of communities and decision makers. But, you know, maybe something very simple that if we're talking about how people take responsibility for how they live and use their environment, the first place we should look is how we interact with decision making, such as in the local council, the regional council, the city council, national government, and so on. Do we actually keep tabs on the decisions that are being made that affect our resources and the implications of those decisions? And here it's especially, you know, what is the regional council doing about water or about contaminated sites, or what are the councils, regional and district, doing about sea level rise and what that will mean for coastal communities. So it's taking an interest in the decision-making processes like that, and then asking questions and saying, where can I get the information from that will help me understand this? And I think that's where the academic community, and I think geographers are pretty good at this, stepping out into the community, doing that sort of, what do they call it, translational research and translational processes, taking the research out of the journals and whatnot, and actually into the community and saying, well, here we have understanding and we have ways of operating. You know, we can set up groups, we can do collaborative management, we can bring stakeholders in, we can network and da-da-da-da, you know. There are things that we can do. And I think there are people in geography who, especially the younger ones, not like me, that are very adept at that and very effective at reaching out and helping make that connection so they can start, you know, influencing, making a difference.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
I think I am still keen on being a university academic. You know, that every year there's new minds coming in and they ask new challenging questions, a bit like the stuff you've been doing. And it makes us stop and think and rethink and perhaps change positions. And, you know, it's energizing and it's rejuvenating every year. And, you know, I can't think of a better sort of job where you can really keep up to speed with modern current affairs about environment or society or whatever, and you're constantly being sort of challenged to...
Are those new minds changing?
They do want jobs compared to perhaps 25 years ago where it was maybe a little bit more laid back, but I think there's still a lot of people coming through who are really, you know, good minds asking good questions.
Yeah. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No. I'm a prodder, a questioner. I tend to be in the background, so this has been a really weird situation for me. I want to stimulate people to think. I don't want to tell them what they should be doing. Now, I think academics are going to be quite careful about that. You can't stand up and say, I'm a professor of geography, therefore my values should influence you. But I could stand up and say, you know, me personally, I think this. What do you guys think?
Do you have a bottom line that would get you out onto the street?
Ooh, yeah, probably.
If the RMA was so decimated that there was nothing left, would that?
No, I think you'd have to be much more close to home, you know, community survival, real problems with people, I think, would get me out onto the streets.
What challenges do you have in the next couple of years?
Uh, work, probably. Surviving change at work, I think, is probably the main thing. I think, for me, the challenge is to hand over some of the things I'm doing in my area of impact assessment nationally, internationally, to people who I hope will keep those sort of initiatives moving. And, you know, it's passing things on. Is continuity is a really important thing. So I think that's a challenge. Step out, let other people move in, but not fade away too much. Just keep prodding.
You've got life left in you yet.
Yeah.
So if you could have a miracle occur overnight, you wave a magic wand and something has changed, or if you don't want to do it in the miracle terms, the smallest thing that would make the biggest difference, what do you think that might be?
I think the solution to sequestering carbon, if our technology, we can find a way to suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere really quickly and efficiently as carbon, you know, as carbonate or something, I'd feel a lot happier, I think, because certainly the issue of warming and everything that seems to be leading to is a bit of a worry, and handing that on to future generations is, I think, not a very nice legacy.
I set that up saying it was a miracle, but are we in danger of perhaps thinking that miracle is going to happen?
I don't think we should be relying on the technological fix, but I think we should be trying our hardest to cover our options. So, yep, okay, try and disinvest from fossil fuels. Very good supplement in The Economist recently on energy, promoting, seeing the success of solar energy coming up really fast, much cheaper. But I think we've also got to be looking at ways to try and, you know, do damage, not just damage limitation, but solve the damage we've done. So technology in that sense, I think, is important as well.
And lastly, in this set of questions, which we meant to get in before everyone else, do you have any advice for listeners?
Sleep well, get good night's sleep, I think, is important. Eat well, and have a work-life balance. All the things I've not really managed to achieve quite yet, but one day I will. Was that the sort of advice you were wanting?
I asked you for advice and you gave me some, so...
Okay, we'll just wrap it up there. Okay, you're listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio on 105.4 FM. This has been the show for the 12th of February, 2015. Our guest tonight was Dr. Richard Morgan. Your hosts were Dr. Samuel Mann and myself, Shane Gallagher. You can get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe in iTunes or on oir.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.